Welcome to The Critique. Today we are looking at the submitted manuscript, Bringing Forth the More Beautiful World, which translates formal systems theory into a lived, relational grammar of life calling to guide civilizational renewal. It's a breathtakingly ambitious text, but let's dive right into how we can elevate this strong foundation, starting with the pacing.
Right, so the rhythmic, repetitive sentence structures, while initially poetic, ultimately dilute the impact of the core arguments through overuse.
Yeah, I definitely felt that while reading.
Right, because the specific weakness here is that the text frequently relies on these consecutive, parallel sentences that are basically organized as lists. I mean, we see this heavily in chapter 2, for example.
When they're exploring Terence Deacon's concepts of absence?
Exactly. The text reads, "The hungry body calls for food. The thirsty body calls for water. The frightened child calls for holding." And we see this exact same structural technique mirrored again later in chapter 5.
Oh, with the Genevieve Vaughn theory, right? About words as gifts?
Yes, exactly. It says, "A true word gives orientation. A good question gives space. A careful distinction gives clarity." And, you know, while this litany style is a really powerful rhetorical device, using it constantly across hundreds of pages creates a halting staccato pacing.
It really does.
It just exhausts the reader's inner ear and prevents the prose from flowing dynamically, causing all these profound insights to just kind of blur together.
I want to look closely at the mechanics of why that exhaustion happens, actually, because the author's intent here is very clear, right? They are trying to syntactically mirror Terence Deacon's theory.
Right, the idea that life is organized by what is missing.
Exactly. The vacuum creates the pull. The hunger dictates the shape of the search. So the author's trying to make the reader feel that urgent, repetitive pull in the actual sentence structure itself.
Which is clever in theory.
It is, but from an editorial standpoint, reading this is, it's like listening to a musical composition consisting entirely of cymbal crashes.
Oh, wow. That is a great way to put it.
Right? Because a cymbal crash is a highly effective way to signal a climax or, you know, jolt the audience awake. But if every single point across 300 pages is framed as a rhetorical crescendo, the reader's ear just becomes entirely numb to it.
Yeah, because there are no valleys to contrast the peaks. When syntax becomes that predictable, the human brain basically enters a predictive loop. It stops actively parsing the deep meaning of the words and just waits for the pattern to end.
Right, it's like semantic satiation, but for syntax. So what's the fix here?
The suggestion is to reserve this incantatory, repetitive style strictly for key emotional or structural crescendos and weave the underlying points into more varied, narrative-driven paragraphs for the bulk of the text.
Okay, let's look at how we can actually implement that. Like in chapter 2, instead of those three separate parallel sentences, I would just combine those points into a flowing structure.
How would that sound?
Something like, whether it is the hungry body calling for nourishment, the frightened child reaching for safety, or the silenced community demanding a voice, life inherently organizes itself around these unmet needs.
Oh, I like that. That maintains the philosophical weight, but lets the reader glide through the concept.
Exactly, rather than stopping at every period.
And we can apply the exact same principle to chapter 5. Rather than listing six separate sentences starting with "a noun gives," we can consolidate those points into a tighter paragraph emphasizing the spectrum of linguistic gifts.
Right, so we bury the repetition.
Yeah, it could read, "Language offers a spectrum of relational gifts. It can provide the orientation of a true word, the space of a good question, or the felt world of a poem."
That is so much smoother. It pulls the reader forward. And honestly, we need to manage the reader's cognitive energy carefully so they make it to the final page. But even with perfect flow, there's another issue blocking the reader.
The jargon?
Yes. Let's get into the audience alignment.
So, the manuscript advocates for a shift from cold abstraction to warm, lived reality, yet frequently traps its own profound insights in dense academic terminology.
Which is highly ironic.
Completely. The core mission of the text is to move away from formal architectures of viability into a language of care and nesting. That is the weakness here. The text heavily utilizes terms like life value, ontoaxiology, biosocial becoming, and metalinguistic gifts.
Right.
While the text explicitly tells the reader it is moving toward lived experience, it lacks the grounded human case studies needed to actually bridge the gap between academic theory and the daily reality of teachers, clinicians, and citizens.
Before we fix it, let's briefly define what these terms actually mean, just so we understand the stakes here. Like, when the author references John McMurtry's life value ontoaxiology.
Quite a mouthful.
It really is. We are looking at a compound of ontology, the study of being, and axiology, the study of value. The text is asking, basically, what is the fundamental value of being? It's arguing that society must shift its metric of success away from capital and toward the capacity of life to thrive.
Which is a beautiful, brilliant framework.
It is. But dropping a phrase like ontoaxiology into a paragraph just creates immense cognitive dissonance. You cannot effectively argue for an accessible, warm civic language using the coldest, most exclusive academic framing available without an immediate translation.
Exactly, because that academic language acts as a gatekeeper. It alienates the exact working-class communities the author wants to reach.
But I have to ask, is there a risk that removing terms like ontoaxiology might strip away the necessary academic rigor? I mean, we don't want to lose the precision of the systems theory and just make it purely sentimental.
No, absolutely not. The suggestion is not to delete the terminology, but to anchor the dense theoretical frameworks immediately in specific, real-world scenarios or historical case studies that demonstrate the theory in action.
So ground it the second you introduce it.
Yes. Maintain the intellectual weight, but instantly show the reader what that weight looks like when it hits the ground.
Let's explore some concrete examples of that. In Chapter 4, the author introduces ontoaxiology alongside McMurtry's concept of the answered life.
Right.
So instead of moving on to the next theoretical point, the author needs to pair this axiom with a vivid story. Imagine reading the definition of ontoaxiology, and the very next sentence takes us to a specific community successfully reclaiming a polluted watershed from a chemical company.
That is perfect. Show the tense town hall meetings, the local advocates fighting for their environment. Show exactly what the transition from unanswered life, the poisoned river, to answered life, the restored ecosystem, looks like.
Because for the people standing on the riverbank, ontoaxiology isn't abstract. It's clean drinking water.
Exactly. And we can do the exact same thing in Chapter 5 with the concept of misnaming as civilizational power. Right now, it's just a theoretical bullet point.
Yeah, it just sits there.
So provide a historical instance of a colonized people reclaiming their native language. Or, you know, bring it directly into a clinical setting. Show a patient actively advocating against a reductive medical label that ignores their lived reality.
Oh, that's a great angle. Showing a patient sitting in a fluorescent lit clinic saying, I am not just a diagnostic code, I am a person experiencing a breakdown in my environment. That perfectly illustrates the theory.
Right, because the human brain requires narrative to process abstract systems theory. By doing this, the academic rigor becomes visible and touchable.
But, you know, grounding these concepts in reality creates a totally new set of challenges. Because when these life-affirming systems actually manifest in the real world, they inevitably clash with entrenched power.
And that brings us to the third major issue. The text envisions a beautiful transition toward a gift-provisioning civilization, but largely sidesteps the practical friction and bad faith exploitation that will resist this shift.
Yeah, it feels a bit overly optimistic in places.
It does. The weakness is that the manuscript presents its paradigms, like Vaughan's language as gift and the evolved nest, with a somewhat utopian gloss. It outlines the ideal state of positive peace beautifully, but it doesn't sufficiently address how easily gift language is co-opted by bad actors, or how deeply entrenched systems will violently resist this transition.
That makes sense. But could the evidence also support a different conclusion? Is there a risk that by focusing so heavily on positive peace and gift, the material might inadvertently disarm the reader against the very real structural violence it seeks to dismantle?
That is exactly the danger. If you teach people to only speak the language of the gift, how do they communicate with a system that only speaks the language of extraction?
Right. Power protects itself.
So the suggestion here is to introduce dedicated sections that grapple with counterarguments, systemic resistance, and the vulnerability of gift dynamics to corporate or political exploitation.
Let's detail what that friction looks like with some concrete examples. Like in Chapter 5, during the discussion of language as a gift, the author should definitely add an exploration of the weaponization of the gift.
Oh, I love that phrasing.
Right. We can detail a scenario where a modern corporation exploits the language of family or community to demand unpaid overtime or mask extractive labor practices.
Because we see that constantly in corporate messaging. The company uses family language to deliberately trigger our biological instinct for loyalty, basically to bypass our critical thinking regarding fair compensation.
Exactly. So the text needs to explain how coherent languaging serves as a diagnostic tool to defend against the specific manipulation. It has to distinguish between a true gift that opens life capacity and coerced sacrifice disguises virtue.
Coherent languaging isn't just about speaking warmly, it's defensive armor.
Yes. And let's look at another example for Chapter 4 regarding the civil commons and positive peace. The author shouldn't just talk about the theory of its success. Let's outline a realistic scenario of a community struggling to protect its public water system from aggressive privatization efforts.
Show the messy, difficult struggle. The corporate narrative will use focus group-tested language, words like efficiency and market growth, to mask the extraction.
And then show the community using the coherent language of life value to shatter that illusion and fight back.
Exactly. Detailing this friction transforms the text from a beautiful philosophical wish into a resilient manual for civic renewal.
Well, we've covered the major areas where this ambitious synthesis of systems theory and life philosophy can be sharpened. Just to recap, we need to vary the repetitive litany-style syntax to improve the overall pacing.
Right, saving that staccato rhythm strictly for true emotional crescendos by consolidating parallel lists into flowing paragraphs.
We also need to anchor dense abstractions like ontoaxiology in concrete human case studies.
Bridging that gap by pairing every major theoretical introduction with a real-world narrative.
And finally, the text must address the real-world friction and potential bad faith exploitation of gift language by entrenched power.
By adding sections explicitly dedicated to systemic resistance and corporate co-optation.
Awesome. We invite the listener to implement these structural and stylistic changes and submit the revised manuscript back in for another critique. Until next time.